FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. Today is Tuesday, May 23rd, 2017, rapidly approaching the halfway mark in the year. So it's a good time to take a look, see what's really been going on with investment returns, with real estate north of the border. And Danielle Park is with us now. We're going to be talking about ETFs, the real cost of ETFs, and whether they're for you or not. And Danielle, welcome back.
Hey, hi, Kerry.
Okay, so first off, real estate. You guys have had the mother of all bubbles in Canada, especially in British Columbia and in Ontario provinces. And now, as a famous religious person down here in the United States said, the chickens are coming home to roost.
Well, no one up here is admitting it's a bubble, Kerry. Very few people. In fact, our Bank of Canada Chief Stephen Poles said last week that the troubles that they've observed so far in some of the mortgage lenders having fraudulent mortgage applications, et cetera, is all very, quote, contained. So you know how that word invokes gag reflex.
Where have I heard that before? I think I heard somebody once say it before during our real estate bust. And what happened? And what's going to happen?
Not very contained, right? Yeah, that was Mr. Bernanke and Greenspan, right? And then it wasn't until after all hell had broke loose in 2000, when was he giving testimony? Greenspan? I think it was like
05 or 06.
But after that, it was about it was after the big bust when he said that the crisis had turned out to be much broader than anything he could have imagined. That was Chairman Greenspan, right? Yeah. So the central banks they're hopeless when it comes to warning about downside risks. They always think everything bad is parceled off and kept away from, even as the Bank of Canada said, you know, it's all contained, but it has emerged as our primary area of concern for the economy because, you know, 84% of our GDP the last 6 or 7 years has come from the home, basically the real estate industry, spending related to homes and finance related to that whole sector. So our banks are heavily exposed up here. The economy has been firing on just that one cylinder for several years. Meanwhile, Canadians are, you know, 169% debt to disposable income, the most indebted of all G7 nations. We have home prices that are trading on average between 5 and 8 times the average household income when the long-term norm is 3. A recent survey, one that came out today, a new one from Manulife, said that 77% of boomers say they want to stay in their home, in their current house, which is understandable, but it represents 60% of their household wealth for nearly half of them, 60% or more of their household wealth. So when you're looking at, you know, this dichotomy between they want to stay where they are, but they haven't got enough savings. And P.S., the wealth that they do have has come through unsustainable gains in home prices, which, you know, another stat, basically, if you look at the current level of prices with gains that have gone up, you know, at a torrid clip the past few years, like 35% and 40% just in the last year, Kerry, you would need a housing correction of something like 40% just to get back in connection with, you know, long-term sustainable ratios with respect to income and affordability. So just even if they lost, you know, 20% of their home value here, that would have a very big effect in wiping out what people consider to be their, quote, net equity. And then, you know, they haven't got enough savings. And whatever savings people do have in this country is disproportionately invested in, as I say, housing. But secondly, if they do have anything in financial assets, they're primarily heavily exposed to the banks, to the REITs, and to the energy companies. And all those things are in the midst of this, you know, mean reversion period that has to happen here. So I'm afraid we're very undersaved and over-concentrated up here. And it doesn't bode well, you know, for our economy or for our taxpayers, the aging demographic. You know, we really have made a hell of a mess of it up here, I'm afraid.
And you had such a perfect example of what not to do. I mean, everything we have done in the U.S. or had done, because I will tell you that the fraud has been reduced remarkably. I mean, I won't say it's non-existent, but we have things like you can't lie about your income because they actually verify it through the IRS. We have things like...
You have things like down payments again, don't you, down there?
Well, in theory. I mean, for FHA, it's like 3-4%. But you can't just go take out that 3-4% down payment mortgage without getting mortgage insurance, A, and having income sufficient. And now the mortgage banks require you to have 6 months worth of mortgage payments in the bank when you close. Now, in the real world, hey, how important is that? Not so much, but it will stop a lot of people who couldn't otherwise afford a house. It will stop you from getting a mortgage, government-backed mortgage. So there have been reforms made. Some will say too much on the other side, but things like bigger down payments are always preferable to smaller ones, because you know what happens when you go negative on your equity. You do a strategic default, and then you wait 3 years or 5 years, and you can get another FHA mortgage and rinse repeat. But you've like done everything that we did, fraud, everything. You've just, we're like the copycat for this. I mean, you just copycatted everything wrong with the U.S. mortgage market.
Yeah. And you see, the thing is, this belief that government backing debt for things like real estate and student debt, student loans, is the way to go has really got us into so much trouble, because all it's done is piled that on, you know, at an unprecedented clip on every level of and every sector. You know, the debt to GDP for the world now is something like 325 debt to GDP ratio, 325%, the highest it's ever been. I noticed your household debt balance in the U.S. has now reclaimed its 2008 peak. Slightly different composition, right? You've got lower mortgage debt or roughly the same. It hasn't increased, but the big jumps have been in auto and student debt and revolving lines of credit. So, you know, you guys haven't delevered down there either, but Canada just went like, you know, batshit crazy in the last few years. I think it came from hubris and overconfidence. It came from all the accolades we unduly received in 2008. The only reason our banks didn't blow up that as much as in the U.S. is we had some stricter regulation going into the crisis that required more checks and balances, just so people couldn't outright make up stuff. And the banks did have to have slightly higher capital ratios. But believe me, they were vexing in vain. They were working the system the whole way. And just as you guys started blowing up, we had already reduced to zero interest only type mortgages, and we had them available in this country for about just under a year before the writing was so clear that we needed to backtrack, and then they started to back out of that. So Canada came into the 08 crisis, you know, with the highest revenues we'd had in some time, thanks to oil prices that went to 147. So, you know, we were really raking in the dough back then, and we had some checks and balances that meant we couldn't go full on crazy in the leverage in the housing space. And then just as they brought that in, luckily you were ahead of us and we started to retreat. But the message that we got out of that was make loans even more available, you know, and this keeping rates, you know, we've had rates below 1% now since 2008-09. And it's not helping anyone. It's going all in the wrong direction. And we've just got toxic levels of risk and over-concentration in an aging population and young people who can't afford to buy any of the assets because they're all obscenely valued. So, you know, something's got to give here. And the something that has to give is in the, you know, promises and entitlements that can't be paid and in insane asset values that can't be maintained. And when they are allowed to finally mean revert, we'll get some actual price discovery and affordability again. And then assets will start to make sense as investments instead of just speculations. So I think, you know, it's going to be a painful period, but it's absolutely essential. Otherwise, we can never restore any kind of reasonable metrics to this system. And that's just, you know, people believe now, you know, that we can keep going on QE and valuations will never matter again. And here was a quote from the report on business in the Globe last weekend. It said, "Realtors agree prices are not going to drop." And of course, I burst out laughing. I mean, it's just so sad, but not that funny.
Well, you know, you just look at it and, you know, it just reminds me of that quote. The one thing you learn from history is that people never learn from history. And this is such a perfect example.
Or as Don Henley says, it's the lure of easy money. I always come back to that. The lure of easy money. You know, everyone wants to believe. It's like you and I were talking about reverse mortgages just before we came on. You know, that's a toxic product, but it is very attractive to people who want to believe that they can stay in their existing home, not change anything, and basically live for free till they, you know, die is the theory, or want to sell it. But all it does is it you think you're having your cake and eating it too. No, you're having some cake and the fees and brokers and product producers are eating the cake till there's nothing left. And it's just the price of impatience, the price of not wanting to know the truth about math. You know, I say we need the courage to see what is the truth in all this. All these product pushers and, you know, fraud and half-truths and cover-ups. It's just such a cesspool right now. And to get the courage to see, you have to, you know, look at the math and say, hey, I need to downsize. I need to relocate. I need to, you know, increase my income from part-time work or for rental income. Anything but throw your chips on the table and think you can gamble your life savings and you know, somehow borrow your way to prosperity. It's been such a toxic time for everyone, and the IOUs are so thick and fast. You know, this money will never be payable back, and we'll have to go through a long period here where we have to rationalize all that.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's not like it's never happened before. We see it happening again and again and again. And, you know, at least once every generation, right? And it just continues on. So we're talking about ETFs before versus mutual funds. I mean, mutual funds, they're 2% fees, 1% to 2% fees per year is basically going to strip your retirement and result.
Well, it's you know, it's not just that. People really focus, I find, the money business gets you to focus on, you know, the whether you're paying $4 or $6 per trade, for example, or whether you're paying 1% or 2% for your management. The thing is that unless it is active management in a sense of actively managing your risk to your lifespan, it is not worth a fee. So most of these products and managers are actually long always. So they never take any steps to protect you against overvaluations. You know, the max they ever hold is 3% to 5% cash at any particular time. So all they are is asset funnelers. They're not actually managing risk. So I say, if you're looking at a mutual fund versus an ETF, and the mutual fund is long always, and they're going to charge you 2%, and the ETF is long always, but they're going to charge you 0.1. Well, clearly you might as well just own the ETF, because you're not actually getting anything for that management fee. All that means is you're going to, you know, be basically underperforming the index on the way up because you're paying a fee. So even if they match the returns of the ETF, you're going to get less. And then on the way down, the fee means that you're going to drop more because they're not protecting your downside, and they're taking out a fee while you're falling. But the real nub of the thing is, you know, and our business model in our fund, in our company, seized on ETFs in the late 90s when they started to come out, because we could see that this was a much better tool than individual stock picking, you know, more diversity, less concentration risk, all that stuff. But our model was already set up on a risk management basis. In other words, we can add ETFs when we want exposure to certain sectors, whether it be equities or corporate debt, but we sell ETFs when we don't want that exposure and we move money to T-bills, to bonds, to cash. That's the only place you can actually get a hedge against downside risk. And so if you're going to pay someone 1% and they're going to actually manage your risk, then that's going to come back in spades. Because when everybody, for example, in 2008, when equities lost half, you know, if you weren't in equities, if you were in the more stable, safe asset classes, you didn't lose that. So you could have even made money. In our case, we actually made about 8% in 2008. So when you come out of that and then you have liquidity to buy, you're years ahead. So the fact that someone pays 1% for that kind of service to not drop 50, Carrie, I mean, so this is what I mean. It's a red herring. It's are you getting any actual active management, which means are they selling the risky asset classes at any point in the cycle to protect you against the downside? If the answer is no, then they're not worth anything. You might as well just be fully strapped on to indexes. Mm-hmm. But somebody better be managing your risk, because, you know, the more people that are getting into their 50s and 60s, this is their third bubble cycle they've been through since 2000. They're now that much later, 17 years later, they have even less time to afford to make back losses over the following years once this next mean reversion hits. So again, it's not just good enough to say ETFs cost 0.1, therefore they're better. Who's managing your risk? And if your advisor's not doing it, by all means, fire them and don't waste funds, you know, on so-called active management that's not active at all. But if you're going to hold these products, realize that you're fully risk exposed and there's no diversity. There's no diversity benefit in international markets versus US versus Canadian. These assets are all very correlated today with international institutions and fund flows the way they are. You know, the world was flooded with liquidity. It flooded into these products. It put your asset valuations back to 2000 levels and above for many things. And yet back, you know, when we look in retrospect, everyone goes, oh, 2000 was a terrible bubble. It was an awful financial, you know, disaster. And then it collapsed. But we're right back there again. And of course, yeah, at the same time, the same talking heads that are long always for these funds and products and collect fees for doing nothing, as well as the central banks who never saw a downturn coming in their whole life, are giving people this false sense of assurance and complacency again, which is devastating in real life terms for people. If they're going to lose their shirt again, then it's going to be now they're how old? 60, 65, and they're supposed to do what? Work another 10 years to get back to where they are today? I mean, this is the kind of thing that we have to really have the courage to see. And the courage to see means there's nobody managing your risk. You better do it, or you better find someone to help you with it.
Hey, that's a great point. And when you talk about managing risk, part of the problem is that you don't really know how much something is really worth. So therefore, if you can't figure out what it's worth, how do you know if the price of it is too high or too low? So you being a professional risk manager, how do you do it?
Well, there's a lot of different tools. We use fundamental and technical filters, but primarily it's very basic math, Carrie. It's, you know, what is the present value of the future cash flows? What are coming to you in the form of interest payments and dividends? And what risk to the principal must you undertake for that compensation? So the thing is, the other thing that people don't understand about the business of investment returns is that they're constantly reported on the assumption that every bit of dividend or interest income has been reinvested throughout.
Right.
So that's the compound rate of return that people see in the marketing brochures and go, ooh, I want that. But most of those are needing to take out some income and or paying some management fees as they go. Where is that coming out of? It's coming out of whatever income flow comes into the portfolio. So if you're withdrawing fees or withdrawing income payments to live on, you are not going to get that full compound return impact that you're assuming is, you know, is coming your way. And so that's part of the reason people always overestimate returns. The, you know, pension funds estimating these 7% returns, which they've come not even half of that, are now recognizing, oh my goodness, we're going to have to double our contribution levels in the next 5 years just to try and catch up to what we've promised in benefits. So again, you know, it's a mathematical, rational exercise. It's a recognition of what is unforeseeable and a recognition of what is foreseeable, and trying to strike a balance, an intelligent mix, not all, you know, risk and not all doom and gloom, but a strategy for taking advantage of things when everyone else is selling in panic, because they always do. It's every single cycle. Within 6 to 8 years, you get this cathartic, everyone realizes they have some overvalued assets and no liquidity. And that's the nub of it. So then they start trying to raise liquidity and everybody's trying to sell at once. That's the cycle we deal with. So if you're going to, you know, if you're going to buy things and put them away for 30 years and not look at them so that you don't panic and that you don't need income and you never have to worry about, you know, needing a lump sum out of that bucket, then that's just some theoretical model that these companies work on, but it's not the reflection of real life for just about anybody in the world. So it's completely nonsense and it does more harm than good every cycle.
Yeah, nothing ever changes, so it seems. And I understand why most people will seek out the advice of a professional. But like you said, you can't be getting a professional who always believes that you should be long, no matter what the market valuations.
Or your age, no matter what your age. I was looking at this series of funds Fidelity has out, target specific date funds. And they say, you know, if you're going to retire in 2025 and 2030 and 2035, they have these different asset mixes. So I thought, okay, I'll look at the 2025 one. Okay, we're talking about, you know, less than, so what are we, 70? We're talking about less than 8 years from now.
Yeah.
They have 70% allocation to equities plus corporate debt right now. So they have almost no cash, 3% cash that's just coming in and going out. And the rest of it is mostly market exposed. And that's supposedly their most conservative mix for people that are expecting to retire within 8 years. That gives you a sense of what kind of madness we're talking about here.
Lunacy. But what can you do? I mean, that's just, I guess education is the key, just like any other potentially self-destructive behavior. You can't stop people from actually doing what's going to be injurious to their health. They have to stop themselves from doing it. And the only way you can do that is if you get the education, the knowledge that's required, except there's so few places to get it nowadays. Well, I think
you need advisors to be fiduciaries that are responsible. If people lose their shirt or have horrendous advice, you have to have some accountability in the industry. That's the other thing. And so far, the government in your side of the world is still, you know, the lobbyists are still trying to push for a reversal of all that again. So we'll see.
Yes, agreed. So hey, check out Danielle's work over at jugglingdynamite.com. Emails to us, kl@carrielutz.com. And the Twitter feed, you can tweet something as well, @CarrieLutz. And the Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. And we will talk to you in a couple weeks, Danielle.
Hey, thanks, Carrie. Bye.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.